Hello, and welcome to the final episode of this series of Material Matters with Grant Gibson. The show is 4 years old now, but for listeners who might be new to all this, the idea is I speak to a designer, maker, artist, or architect about a material or technique with which they're intrinsically linked and discover how it changed their lives and careers. Before we start, I'm delighted that the headline sponsor for this series of the podcast and the Material Matters Fair is Burt Frank. The company crafts beautiful lighting to order from its manufacturing base in Birmingham, using traditional methods paired with the latest technology. Skilled craftsmen rely on their years of expertise and the finest quality materials to produce timeless investment pieces that will last a lifetime, going to great lengths to ensure all clients can rely on a bespoke service and a unique, beautifully engineered product. So, the question is where to start with this week's guest. Beattie Wolfe is a musician and artist who has in her time been described as a musical weirdo and visionary, and one of the 22 people changing the world. In a relatively short career, she's created a 3D interactive album app, a musical jacket, worked in the world's quietest room to develop an anti-stream, fired her music into space, made a documentary with the Barbican, designed an environmental protest piece entitled From Green to Red, which was shown at the Nobel Prize Summit, worked with people suffering from dementia, and recorded a track for a 12-inch record made of bioplastic alongside Michael Stipe. Her latest project, Imprinting the Artist's Brain, was on show as part of the recent London Design Biennale at Somerset House, and is a sonic self-portrait that involves old-school telephones as well as a thinking cap designed by an iconic tailor. The theme running through all this is her desire to rematerialise music and give it back a sense of tangibility and ceremony. Beattie, thank you very much for doing this.
Wow, what an intro. I don't think I need to say anything now. That's it.
Trust me, you do. We have a full hour of this, and you. So how are you? Oh, and where are you currently? Because you live in LA, but you're currently in London, right?
I do live in LA. I am currently in London for this exhibition at Somerset House, which runs for another couple of weeks. I am in a distant relative's apartment.
Okay.
Or a flat, because we're in London.
Before we get going properly, I was at a small talk you gave last night at 34 Montague Square, the history of which we'll talk a bit about later. And the audience discovered that you always keep a shard of space rock in your right pocket. So a couple of questions. How did you acquire said space rock? And why do you always keep it about your person?
Well, it's actually two. There are two of them. The space rocks, plural. I think I got both of them out, but, you know, maybe Greg just didn't translate that. So I got given them by Dr. Randy Wesson, one of the chief engineers at NASA. And he gave them to me after I'd given this talk to all the engineers. And this was, I don't know, a number of years ago now, 4 or 5 years ago. And after this talk, he showed me these atmospheric CO2 graphs, which dated back 800,000 years, that ultimately became From Green to Red. And we just became friends. And he, you know, one night we were meeting for a beer and he had these space rocks. And I think he thought I would be excited by them or, you know, like, oh, that's nice. But every time I've seen him since, I'm like, Randy, you know, I still have them in my pocket. And he's incredibly touched by that. So, yeah, I think that also made it into the Barbican documentary.
Well, it did.
It did, yeah.
And also, because nobody asked last night what you keep in your left pocket, because you generally have something quite specific in there.
Yeah, well, at the moment, Grant, actually, I have a bit of selenite in my left pocket. In the right pocket, along with the space rocks, there are some other sort of curiosities. I was quite happy when I found out Rauschenberg used to keep things in his pocket and he'd actually ask people to empty their pockets, because I was doing an exhibition at the Rauschenberg Gallery and working with that, you know, curator. He told me that. I kind of liked that because then I thought, okay, I'm not, there's someone else in my weird pocket camp. I also have a penny, an angel penny that literally is an angel penny. It's like a penny with a little angel head on it. And that was from a very dear friend, Ali Willis, songwriter, Hall of Famer, amazing multimedia artist, and my best friend in LA. And, you know, she passed away a couple of years ago, just before lockdown. And, you know, that was a big shock. So I always keep my Ali angel penny in there as well. Yeah. And a few other things, but, you know.
Very nice. Shall we talk about why you're in London, which is the London Design Biennale, currently running at Somerset House? You've done what's described as a sonic self-portrait. As I said in the intro, there are lots of old school telephones which have been painted, attached to the wall, the cables of which lead to a cap, like a retro thinking cap. So what's going on?
Well, it's really a way of taking you inside the artist's brain. I had this idea that it'd be really cool to sort of explore how many different channels we've got going on simultaneously. Like, definitely from the projects that I've done, I've ended up working in all these different areas in these fields beyond even like music, design and art into science and, you know, technology and health. And working with all these different types of people, it became so hard to kind of introduce myself in a way, but hard both because I, you know, I'm also happy just not really saying anything and just letting people see the work. But I realized that we so early on have to define ourselves as one thing or another, and we put ourselves in these boxes and these lanes that education and society really encourages and dictates. And then often we just stay there and we kind of have this very limited view of who we are and what we're capable of. I wanted to bring all of that multidisciplinary, multifaceted, dimensional self to life. And so, yeah, you have 8 phones in this amazing gallery space in Somerset House. I'm between Ukraine and Romania.
Yeah, you're not a nation state. Just to make clear.
Not yet. Not yet. Yeah, I've got great neighbors, really lovely neighbors. And so, yeah, you have 4 phones on each side of the wall. It's kind of like the space in those old institutional buildings where you'd expect to see phones. So there's something really lovely about the space. It's kind of the perfect space for it. And each of the phones is decorated with the channel's kind of content that you're hearing, but like in note form, like as if I'm just writing on a journal or something. And then you pick up the phone and you're listening to the audio connected with a different area of the brain. So it's the inner self channel, and that's in the hippocampus, and that's where I've recorded all these journals I wrote as an adolescent. Or it's, you know, the music channel, one of the music channels in the limbic system, or the conversations channel in the Wernicke's area, where I'm talking with Shirley Manson about truth, or Brian Eno about art and climate, and all these big theme, big picture conversations. The memory channel, you know, a lot of home movies. The sounds channel, a lot of the shipping forecast and early things that really imprinted. What else is there? Collaborations channel, you know, the postcards project, the space broadcast, the work with Linda Perry in the studio. It's like you're really hearing these different sonic portraits sort of via each phone. You know, each phone is a very different experience, and the audio is edited very differently. And then all of those phones run into this thinking cap, which I made with Mr. Fish as the sort of follow-up to the musical jacket. And the data related to each channel is actually encoded within a tiny piece of glass that's located on the cap at the corresponding point that it, you know, connects with that area of the brain. And that's really exciting new storage technology that is entirely green. You can write huge amounts of data into glass, not use any energy, and that is preserved for 10,000 years.
So it doesn't sit on a server, in other words.
Exactly.
It needs cooling the whole time. It can just sit in these really quite small slivers of glass.
Yeah, exactly. The platter that I showed last night, that holds a terabyte of data. It's incredible. It's a really big breakthrough.
Fascinating. And was it a curious sensation looking back at your younger self?
Yeah, it was. I think I've always been in touch with my younger self. I think that's maybe the best answer in a way, because it sort of felt like a continuation. You know, I know there are people that they're horrified to look at like how they were when they were younger, or they're really identified with that, you know, and I didn't really have either. I just, I was sort of like, oh yeah, you know, that was me doing that thing. And I think definitely in terms of the conflicting aspect, I had very strong perfectionistic tendencies from a very young age. I was very self-critical. I'd tear up a drawing that I'd done and people would be like, oh, that's great. And I'd just be constantly like tearing up my drawings.
At what age is that, BT?
You know, Grant, I haven't actually talked about this before, so it's coming out now for some reason. I think it was from like when I was 6, maybe. Mm. But actually, art was my first, even probably before songwriting. I really loved painting and drawing, and I was pretty good at it. And yeah, then I just started becoming very self-critical. And also with the song, one of the first songs I wrote, which you heard last night, you heard part of, I was 9, you know, and it was a song called Pink Balloon. And I'd written songs before that, but this was the one I've found a recording of. And at the end of this tape cassette demo, you hear me say, you know, oh, I've totally messed that up. And I haven't been able to actually listen to that song since then, which is, you know, close to 30 years ago. So that's kind of crazy that I so remember that being this epic fail that I was for like decades, I haven't been able to return to it. And then I listened to it, you know, a month ago, like recently, bringing it into this piece. And I was like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? I'm like a child. And actually, pretty good song. And the lyrics, I remember the music teacher thought I was like smoking pot or something. He was a bit worried. Yeah, you know, I mean, at 9, because the opening verse is, I died today and born in life. My mind is gone. I sit and dream. My brain is numb, a space for rent. A pink balloon flying on a witch's broom. You know, it's like, it's pretty...
Yeah, that's quite intense.
It's pretty psychedelic.
Yeah. I mean, and was that typical subject matter for your songs at that age?
Oh, you know, my blue period. No,
I just wonder what kind of pop songs an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old writes.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking pop. I was definitely thinking, you know, avant-garde. Yeah, I mean, my first song, like one of the first ones I remember, it was a bit younger. I think I was like 7 or 8. And it was called You Can't Get Away From Me, Girl. I had a whole dance routine and my backing singers, and we were performing it at assembly where other kids were doing like traditional, you know, whatever was Spice Girls or All Saints or whatever. And I was like, no, the thought didn't even cross my mind that you would do a cover. Of course, I'm going to do one of my original songs. And we, yeah, got this whole bit worked out with the dance and the backing singers. And we got on stage and they went completely mute and just stood there and didn't sing a word and didn't do anything. And so I did the whole thing on my own and remember people like laughing. My mom said afterwards that it was because I was just doing it on my own, but it was a pretty traumatic memory. And, you know, people were definitely like, why is she singing about a girl? Like, oh, what's going on there? And I was just like stepping into the role of, you know, storyteller. It's like, I didn't think anything was bizarre about that.
Let's go back to your work and the piece in London, because I'm interested in the cap, because as you've pointed out, it was made by the tailor, Mr. Fish or David Mason. It was a renowned 60s label that created clothes for the likes of Mick Jagger, Peter Sellers and David Bowie, as you've alluded to.
And Hendrix. Yeah.
This wasn't the first time you've worked with him. I mean, we first met back in 2016 when you literally created an album jacket. I mean, a jacket that you wore as opposed to a jacket for an album. It was created from fabric from your song Take Me Home by textile designer Nadia Ann Ricketts. She takes music and runs it through some software to create a pattern that is then woven. Can you tell listeners a bit more about that project? Because it's centered around 34 Montague Square that we've talked about a little bit, but that has a lot of rock history that maybe we can unpick.
Yeah, 34 Montague Square is definitely one of the places, you know, I feel the work has kind of been born out of. There are certain places, I feel like, you know, physical environments for me are very important. And also like historical instruments, you know, whether it's the horn antenna or the Bell Labs anechoic chamber, there are just these spaces that seem to have a resonance that I really respond to. And obviously with 34 Montague Square, you've got like so much incredible culturally significant history there, from Yoko and Lennon doing the Double Virgins cover and obviously living there.
That's the cover where they're naked and you get to see their bums, which was quite scandalous at the time, right?
Yeah, totally. And, you know, and then you've got Hendrix writing The Wind Cries Mary in that room we were sitting in, and McCartney writing Eleanor Rigby. And, you know, just this, I mean, that's just really kind of pulling out some of the highlights. And it was all very serendipitous, you know, the musical jacket. I'd been thinking, as I had prior to that, like from the first record, from 8, you know, how we can essentially create these more tangible ceremonial experiences in the digital age, you know, and create something that still has like a tangible art form that can still tell a story, that still has like a ceremony to it, and where you're essentially taking the best of the digital and physical. Because I felt like we'd gone from physical to digital so quickly, we hadn't actually figured out what was the best of both worlds. And we still haven't figured that out. I mean, you know, all of the recent NFT stuff, which is now nicely fading into the background, finally. For me, that's the worst of both worlds. With the jacket, that was a component of the album that we lost, you know, very much so. And that was an art form. And so I'd been thinking about album jackets and like all the different aspects of records that kind of got disseminated in the digital era, and bumped into David, now Mr. Fish, at a show. And he'd said, oh, come over, have a cup of tea in this place I'm living. And was very casual about it. And then, you know, you walk in there and he's telling me the history. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is insane, you know. And I could feel the energy in that space. You know, I could feel it last night. I mean, I feel like it's forever imprinted in me and on me. So as he was describing it, and I'm thinking, well, I'm sitting here with this tailor and he could make a jacket, an album jacket that could essentially reimagine this format, it literally be a jacket. And he's got all this history of putting Bowie in dresses and Jagger in dresses. And so he could put me in a suit jacket. That would be kind of cool. And we could record it, you know, the music in this space, and it could have all that resonance. And, you know, and then, yeah, meeting Nadia was like the last piece where it's like, oh my God, I know someone that can take this recording and translate it into a fabric. And then that can be cut into this one-off art piece, really. And I remember joking with David that like, oh, I bet the V&A are going to be calling us up and asking to exhibit it. And then a year or so later, I got asked to do an exhibition at the V&A, you know, with the Bowie Is director, curator, who was there last night, Victoria Brokes, who I just love and is, you know, a wonderful person and friend. And yeah, it was kind of crazy. It's like, great, the jacket in amongst these other items and pieces, installations that I was showing, was then exhibited in the V&A. And then when I met the Queen in my jacket as like the best of British innovation. So yeah, it was a wonderful way of weaving these different things that I love together and telling the story of the house and the tailor and, you know, have this bigger sort of message to it. So when I was thinking about imprinting and that being at the London Design Biennale and not all of the elements, you know, some of the elements were still a little abstract, but I knew I needed a thinking cap because, you know, how else are you going to visualize or sort of conceptualize entering into the artist's brain? And there really was no one else, you know, I could imagine making a thinking cap with. So yeah, that was the connection.
But heading back to this jacket, you probably had to wear it solidly for 2 years every time you performed, right?
No.
You're allowed to take it off occasionally.
Because right after that, it was like South By. I was out in South, you know, in Austin, and there were all these performances or whatever, and it was 100 degrees in Austin. And I was wearing the jacket and I just thought, yeah, this is no. Because at that point, you know, yeah, you do a few performances and you kind of, you take it on the road. But then it actually becomes this really precious, you know, and kind of priceless item. So then I became very conscious about keeping it safe.
Right. But it was embedded with technology. It was the idea as well. So you could tap it with your phone and your songs would come up.
Yeah, well, so the counterpart to, you know, Montague Square, which was the name of the record, was this deck of cards, this NFC album deck of cards, which was also, you know, the first of its kind. And that was a record as a deck of cards that looked a bit like a tape cassette. You opened it up, you had a card for each track off the album with the artwork and the lyrics. And you tap that to your phone and via an invisible chip, it would pull up the content, you know, everything related to that song. Yeah, it was this sort of tangible format that actually had this really exciting invisible digital application to it. So I decided to sort of pull that across into the jacket. So you could also tap the jacket, you know, and hear the music that was woven into it. And I've been working a lot with Mark Mothersbaugh from Devo on a few projects, but it was quite sweet because that was really the first time I met him. I was showing him this deck of cards and he's like, I always remember when you came in and you had that, your deck of cards, your album deck of cards. And I was like, that's so Devo. We should have done that. But, you know, you got there first. And, you know, that for him was like, oh my God, an album is a deck of cards, you know. So,
yeah. So Montague Square was your second album and your first was, well, it was described as a theatre in your pocket. So what did that entail?
It's so funny. Like, I haven't even, thought about a lot of this stuff.
Well, now's your chance.
Because, you know, there's always so much happening. In a good way, because I definitely never wanted to be someone that did one thing and then just did that. But I often have this weird amnesia where I actually, until someone says, oh, there was that project, I'm like, oh, yeah, but it just feels like another lifetime. But yeah, the 3D theater for the Palm of the Hand, that really began it all. And I remember that so vividly in terms of the conception of that, because had seen that, you know, iTunes was now the way of releasing your music. And that was just so dull and depressing for me. And I thought all artists are going to be coming up with weird alternative methods. I just thought that was so obvious. And so I was thinking, well, how could you take like a vinyl and kind of put it on your phone or like, or really turn your phone into, because now everyone's, you know, on their phones. This was 10, 11, 12 years ago, obviously now even more so. But how can you turn the phone into a kind of magic box, like the 80s viewfinder, and have them be able to watch this record in this sort of 3D holographic way? And I was in LA at the time, just actually visiting a friend and having a chat with this coder I worked with on that. And he was like, oh, you know, I saw this kind of Japanese device. You might want to check it out. A thing called the Palm Top Theater. It just come to market, like it had never been used before. And so then I developed this idea to sort of create a 3D interactive app, which then used this projection, essentially. It was like a Pepper's Ghost mechanism and created this way of the phone becoming a kind of viewfinder experience. So, yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, and not content with that. We're not going to go through every project, but I do want to talk about this one, which is your third album, which was Raw Space, which was described as an anti-stream. And you work with Bell's Labs Anechoic Chamber, or in Bell's Labs Anechoic Chamber, which is the quietest room in the world. How did that come about, and what did you do there? I remember meeting you and Nick at Somerset House outside, and you made me wear these goggles, which I really didn't want to do, and was quite blown away by it.
So Rural Space, yeah, which was the third record, 2017, it was this anti-stream. It was also the first live 360 AR experience. Live 360 had only just been done. We were really pushing the parameters of what was possible. And actually, we could only even find a platform to host it on, which was ended up being YouTube, because Eric Schmidt had seen a description I'd sent Bell Labs of the idea. And he was like, this is the coolest thing. YouTube has to be compatible for this. We were really definitely working on the edge at that point. But for me, like, the tech always has to be behind the scenes, an invisible facilitator. You know, it's never about the technology. But really what that whole world, that whole live stream did was open up this kind of Fantasia experience for the album. And, you know, my idea was just to create an alternative form of streaming so that people could actually have this really amazing ceremonial, visual, intentional experience. And it was from, you know, the room where Helen Keller experienced silence for the first time, where they discovered psychoacoustics and rogue frequencies. There was a record player playing the album 24 hours on repeat, this sort of beautiful, lonely record player in this space where John Cage and all these amazing artists had done these experiments in the 60s. I was actually rebooting this program called Experiments in Art and Technology 50 years later, which began with Cage, Rauschenberg, Warhol. And so you'd come into this chamber, you know, you'd be transported into this chamber and, you know, watch the record come to life with the live AR streaming out of the vinyl and turning the chamber into the visual landscape of each track as it was happening in real time. And that came about because I was at Bell Labs actually working on something else. They'd invited me to come and see if I could collaborate with them on another project because they'd seen the other work and they were really excited. And yeah, these are the people that invented the transistor, you know, the telephone, like so many things. So I was in this room of like multiple PhD engineers, you know, many of them.
Do you find that intimidating when you're with these people? You've collaborated with lots of people across the spectrum of disciplines. Do you ever walk into a room and kind of swallow hard and think, oh my God, I've bitten off too much here?
No, I actually often find what in theory should be the most intimidating environments or people to speak to the easiest. And I kind of find all the other stuff in the middle. And when I say middle, just like, you know, more everyday things, I find that more challenging. But I feel so comfortable. And I think it's just often, I don't know, just like firstly, you're talking to another human being. And I've kind of never really distinguished this person has, you know, this big fancy degree. And so I don't know, I just think we're all people. And so to find the kind of commonality, but in a way, I do often find, you know, a lot of like minds in maybe those unlikely spaces. So yeah, I was in this environment with all these engineers and we were working on something else and I knew that it wasn't going to work, but I really liked them, you know, and I kind of felt there was something else we were going to do together. And one of the engineers, you know, said, hey, do you want to go into the anechoic chamber that we have here? You know, people can't stay in there too long because you can hear the blood moving through your veins and we can only stay in there for 20 minutes and we have to take breaks. And so I went in there expecting to have this like extreme reaction and like I have to leave. But I found it to be the most peaceful, incredible, calming space. Like Montague Square, I just immediately felt at home. And I ended up spending over 100 hours, you know, in that room over the course of doing this project together.
Mm. And it was raw space, and you've mentioned the Horn antenna, that got fired into space.
It did, yeah.
With the help of Robert Wilson.
Yes, yeah.
So you are floating around the galaxy somewhere.
I am. Yeah, and that was wonderful. You know, the Bell Labs project led into this space broadcast with Dr. Robert Wilson, who discovered cosmic microwave radiation with this historic Horn antenna and, you know, won a Nobel Prize. And that, again, was just so serendipitous. You know, we'd wanted to meet. I'd asked if we could meet in front of the Horn, because I was fascinated by it. Similarly, was this sort of like lonely instrument that was almost gathering dust. You know, no one was remembering why it was so wonderful in a way. Well, that's how it felt to me. And, you know, I said to him, well, you've used this to receive, but have you ever used it to transmit? And he's like, well, no. I'm like, well, you know, I have this record called Raw Space, which is actually called Raw Space about this anechoic chamber rather than a space thing, but maybe we could send it into space. And he's like, no, the sound waves will get to a point in the Earth's atmosphere and then they'll stop. And, you know, I thought, okay, that's the end of the chat. And, you know, we had a really nice chat otherwise. And, you know, that included, it was a nice no. And then he went away and I got an email from him a month later saying, BT, I figured it out. I can do an update on the Horn and we can send your record into space if you still want to do it. And, you know, you're not going to say no to that. So we did that. And that was such a wonderful collaboration. And then he actually introduced me when I was showing the CO2 project, which weirdly came out of that space broadcast, because then I ended up at NASA and giving this talk and, you know, saw the CO2 graphs. And so it's all connected. And then, you know, I showed From Green to Red at the Nobel Prize Summit. That was where it was first unveiled and presented. And Dr. Robert Wilson introduced me. That was so lovely because it was like, you know, this full circle thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you said in an essay you wrote for the online design magazine, DZine, that, and I'm going to quote, there is a fine balance between what needs to be innovated and what needs to be preserved. And I'm wondering where that line is for you.
Well, if it was really obvious, you know, I think every project or everything you did would be the same.
Mm.
So it's a hard thing to know where that line is, but I feel like I know where that line is just instinctively and intuitively, I think we have felt that technology and innovation and growth has always been good, you know, and it's really realizing that technology has seriously fast-tracked so much of what it means to be a human being on this planet, but it shortchanged us in so many ways, and it hasn't reflected the costs in the fast-tracking process. And it's got us disconnected from two things that we really need to preserve and we need to fight for, which are, you know, our connection with the natural world and the value of art to us as sentient beings. So I feel like there's just this constant, for me anyway, like looking way back, you know, looking really at ancient practices and principles and ideas, which often are also very simple, and then thinking, okay, how can we kind of keep one antenna in that space? And then how can we pull in what's maybe going to present that or give that a new form in today's world by bringing in, say, the exciting things that technology can do in, as I said, again, very invisibly, just like a kind of, ooh, this gives it another dimension, you know, but it's not about the technology in any way. And I think that's also the problem, is so often we get excited with a tool and we don't have any idea why we're using it. We don't really know what it even is. It's just, oh, there's this, and let's all jump on this and drink this Kool-Aid. And I feel like there's a lot that will never go out of, it's not even fashion, it's just there's a lot that we'll never do better if we continue to kind of update. You know, you think about taking like a real simple song on a piano or a guitar, whatever it is, it's been around for however long, and it's, I feel it will continue to be around, and you don't really need to augment or add many ingredients to that. It will just, if it's a good song and it's someone's, and it's an emotive experience and performance, that's just always going to work, you know? And I also think the natural world just has such infinite intelligence and technology, and of course, art, inspiration, imagination, but really technology, that we are so blind and kind of so in love with our own self-image that we just don't see. And that's my frustration, is that actually the best technology exists in the natural world, but we really have to catch up to it. But civilizations used to be much more in tune with it. We just seem to be in this point of collective amnesia right now.
Hope you're enjoying the episode. Just to let you know, the Material Matters Fair with headline sponsor lighting specialist Bert Frank is returning to the Barge House from the 20th to the 23rd of September. Once again, each of the five floors will be doing something slightly different, but all will be related to materials. There'll also be a talks program, some returning exhibitors, so the recycled aluminium giant Hydro will be there, as will the Wood Awards, Solid Wool, Hagen Hinderdal, Mixed Metals and Blake Joshua, for example. And there'll also be some exciting new names, such as the Tire Collective, Biomatters, Nova Vita Design, Anna Bridgewater, also known as Abalon, Plank, Goldfinger, The Wicker Story, Jarl Newman, and Regular Concrete, with others to follow. There will also be a special installation from Milan-based platform Isola. If you're interested in taking part, do drop me a line at hello@materialmatters.design. That's hello@materialmatters.design. Guitar.com described you as having an old soul. Is that something you'd agree with?
I don't know. I don't really think about myself in that way, even with how you introduce yourself or what you are or who you are. I feel like I just do what I do, and I get really inspired by the work, and that's why I'm here. And almost like how whatever people think or how I come across, I guess it's, I'm not really that interested in the me in it, which is funny because obviously imprinting is, there's quite a lot of me in it.
There is. I mean, it's like all you, really, let's face it.
Yeah, but then I feel like it's me, but it's actually collective. And I feel like that's the best stuff when, if you do something personal, which I tend not to do, I mean, all of it is personal because every project I believe in, it's so deeply what I want to say or what I want to convey. But it's also not really about me and it's about the work. And it's like once you've created that project and it's out in the world, you just let it do its thing and there's no attachment to that and there's no need to be validated through that. So I think also with the imprinting, it is much more personal, but then also I feel like that's a way of allowing people to see the self. So almost if it's me seeing myself, but actually that's just the prism, then that really excites me, you know. And I've seen a lot of people come through the exhibition and have these really profound experiences and reactions to it. And so that's when I know it's doing its thing, which again, isn't really even about me or my agenda. It's just, I do feel like it's like having an antenna up there and you're just receiving these ideas and you're bringing them into being and you're bringing them into existence, and almost that's the purpose, and you're just really a custodian of it. So as much as there's self there, there's no ego, I feel. And that's also, I guess, what allowed me, when you were saying at the beginning, to, you know, go back and look at the younger self. There were those uncomfortable things for sure, but then actually moving through that and kind of piecing it back together and just finding peace at the end of it. That was definitely quite a profound experience.
Interesting. I'm keen to know a bit more about your background, actually, Beattie. What did your parents do?
My parents, the two weirdest, but also like, yeah, most brilliant, in my opinion, human beings. You know, I wouldn't say parents. I'd say they're really fascinating, original thinking, divergent, curious human beings, curious in both senses of the word. And you know, my dad was a rare bookseller. He was a dealer in science and natural history, botanical books, but he could never afford a shop. You know, my parents split up when I was a baby. And so he lived in this flat. He had all his rare books in the flat. And so I'd go over there and there'd be a Ptolemy, a Galileo, or an Origin of the Species, Copernicus. And I'd be, you know, wanting to look through these books, but really scared that I was going to break or, you know, ruin this rare text. And he'd say, no, these were made to last. Like, you can look through these. And that really imprinted, you know, this idea that you could make something that was a way of communicating a discovery. It was this way of patenting an idea. It was an art form. It was a portal in time. And it was also made to last. You know, it was something that was made well at the time. And so it endured. And it wasn't even that they knew. It's not like people think, oh, I'm going to make this for thousands of years or whatever. But I think that's also when you make something in the moment as well as it can be made and there's no other agenda, it often will last, you know?
It's kind of a definition of craft, really.
Yeah.
It's very Richard Sennett's court, that kind of definition, which is interesting. He, your dad, was mentioned in a Rolling Stones track, right? Sympathy for the Devil.
Yes, he was. So my dad had two lives, as did my mom. I grew up with my rare book-selling dad and my journalist and therapist mother. And my dad actually had this whole other lifetime as this part of the beat scene with Cassidy and Ken Kesey and all these guys. Terence McKenna is my godfather. That was his best friend. He ended up in this, Sympathy for the Devil. We lay traps for troubadours who get killed before they reach Bombay. I found out all of this way later, like, you know, into my late teens. And that was just, he would only give me like a fragment of something. He still won't give me almost any of the truth. And the thing that's...
I quite want to hear his sonic self.
I would. And it's actually, it's both fascinating and frustrating because so many people who'd had that kind of experience or life, they would be telling everyone. They would have written a book. They would be dining out on it. He is the opposite, as is my mother. You know, my mother wrote the first book on punk rock, in the UK as it was happening, 78.
Did she write that with Danny Baker?
No, that's her book.
I've seen it attributed to the pair of them, but no, it was her book alone.
It was her book. He did the foreword. She got him to do the foreword.
There you go.
And, you know, she also did this documentary and she got him in that because they were pals. And, you know, he wasn't doing that kind of stuff at the time. So that was also the first time he'd appeared kind of on camera in the documentary she did. And I'm telling her all the time, Mom, that's really cool. Like, you know, obviously still now. And, you know, buying the book and giving it to friends and, like, you know, the people that have that book as their cornerstone book, like, it's a really heavy hitting group. And she's so uninterested. She so doesn't care or think it's cool or, you know, and she's much more interested in, like, you know, in other stuff. And, you know, she's kind of on another dimension as well. So it's so funny because these two people that, like, have done these very culturally significant things have no desire to talk about it, are actually almost it's the opposite. It's like trying to extract water out of a stone. But I also really respect that because they don't think like that. They're about doing good work and they're about finding people of integrity and celebrating the good things in life and the environment and social issues. And I guess they don't have any of that stuff. I don't know what it is. What is it, Grant? You know, when people want to be associated with things, whether it's ego, I don't know, because they, you know, of course they have their egos, but it's just not in that area. And they were always doing their own thing. You know, both were independent people. My dad worked for a bookselling firm, Quaritch, for a long time, but then he made, you know, the two best sales for the firm. And my mom said, you should go into business on your own. And for him to really not have a shop and end up as this, you know, he's really kind of the science dealer just because he has such a good eye and he's so trustworthy. Yeah, I'd say people of integrity and people of real substance. That's my parents.
Were you surrounded by music as a child?
I was, because of, you know, my mom and my dad, but I was living with my mom. My mom really raised me and my brother on her own, pretty much. She had a great record collection, you know, because of course, some of the stuff I mentioned, but just she always was had a very good musical sense. I think she wanted to be a singer. I think that's really actually what she would have loved to do. And so, yeah, there were great records and tapes and things like that. But I was also really into writing songs. It's like books, you know, even with my dad and his library, beyond the rare books, he'd have all these early beat texts that friends had written that, you know, would now be really worth a lot because of who was writing them. And I was kind of like, oh, I just want to write my own thing rather than reading. I always had this thing where I'd rather be creating than absorbing. You know, I loved records and I remember key ones early on that definitely went in very deep. And, you know, I loved obviously like stories and hearing stories. But yeah, I was always more into creating and just generating and being a kind of creation station from a young age.
Yeah, yeah. As well as being a ninja, right? You wanted to be a ninja. You have a black belt.
Well, I had a black belt. I think now I'd make a pretty poor ninja. But as a teenager, I had a black belt. I did it for many years. And I was the only girl and kid in this group of like all adult men. And yeah, I fucking loved it. You know, if you could say, hey, have an alternative life, you know, it would totally be a ninja. And me and my best friend, I think we heard a little bit of it yesterday. We used to dress up in my ninja outfits. Because there were ninja outfits, you know, and Joe's, the wooden sword and the ninja stars and the obviously like the special sock shoe thing. So we'd dress up in these outfits and then run along our rooftops because she lived down like two doors down from me. And these were really messed up roofs. You know, these were roofs that you could fall through in a second. And yeah, we thought it was the best thing ever. And then we got caught and got in quite a lot of trouble.
So one of the most intriguing moments, BT, in your documentary, Orange Juice for the Ears, is where you turn to the filmmaker and you say you remember being born and being in the womb. Do you remember every minute of your life in that case?
No. Oh, no. I mean, I think if you remembered every minute of your life, you'd probably be like clinically insane. No, I remember a lot, and I think it would be a whole other show to go into that. But I will say that I remember being in the womb. I remember being born and, yeah, not being happy about it. And I remember being a baby, and my mom has worked out that I was about 10 months, because when I described the pattern on the crib, you know, there was this like pattern around the four sides of the crib with these bears. And so she said, well, you only had that until you're 10 months around that age. So I remember lying in the crib and looking at the time, looking at this clock, this big wall-mounted clock above the door, and thinking, when's time going to hurry up? Because I came here to do things. And that was such a strong experience. I can still be there now. So yeah, I definitely was a odd child, and I definitely feel, though, that that actually gave me the grounding for the work that I've done. It was very, very clear to me what I wanted to do, and not always like what I wanted to do, but why I wanted to do it. And I knew what I liked, you know, even at school where you sort of adopt another identity or you do things to go along with a group or whatever. I just could never do that. And sometimes that was pretty alienating, but I just was always like, yeah, oh, I, you know, assembly, we need to do a song. I'll write my own, even if people think it's weird. Or I think that that was a bit of a blueprint in terms of just doing things, even when people thought they were weird or when people said it wasn't possible. That almost became like, oh, if they say it's not possible, then I'm probably definitely going to need to do that, you know?
So. I mean, I was intrigued, BC, that you didn't study music. You did English at Goldsmiths College. So why did you do that? I mean, at that point, were you thinking of making a career elsewhere, or was it always going to be music?
It was never going to be music. I mean, I didn't even think of a career, you know? Mm. I was just like, how do I keep exploring the things that I want to explore, which was what I was doing as a kid, which I feel lots of kids do. How do I just keep doing this and exploring whatever I'm curious about? And of course, music was something I loved. Literature, writing, you know, I wrote from a very young age. And actually, I got my dad, you know, one of the first kind of things we do together, he would transcribe these stories I'd write from about 3 or 4, and we've got a collection of these, which are, you know, a little one tone, but I was pretty young. So,
Well, we'll forgive you in that case.
Yeah. I loved storytelling, and I felt like if you could learn to write as well as possible, then, and not even as well as possible, but it just, if you explore that, that could be kind of interesting. The reason I didn't want to study music, that actually happened pretty early on, because I'd started getting guitar lessons when I was an early like teenager. And of course, I was writing a lot of songs at that point. And everything I liked about what I was coming up with in terms of the suspended chords, or, you know, these things, again, that weren't really textbook, the teacher would say, oh, no, you can't do that. You should go to this chord, or you should, you know, so I thought, well, this is weird, because all the stuff I like is the stuff he's telling me not to do. So I'm just not going to have lessons, and I'll just keep doing what I hear, you know, what my ear is telling me to do. And then I ended up working a lot with Wynton Marsalis, you know, the Grammy. I think he's the only person to win Grammys for both classical and jazz. Mm. And he's a real purist, you know, he knows his stuff. He knows the rules so well. He, of course, knows how to break every one. And I had the experience of him going through my songs and playing them with me, and him simultaneously analyzing them and being like, oh, wow, like, yeah, you know, you answered this suspension with that suspension, or, you know, just sort of kind of talking to himself, but like going through them and being like, oh, yeah, this is great. And and after that, anytime I was in the studio and someone said, oh, you can't do such and such, I'd be like, look, if it's good enough for Wynton, then it's fine.
I mean, do you find the songwriting process easy? It sounds like you must do if you've been at it since the age of 8.
Yeah, I find the songwriting process very easy. I mean, a bit like the ideas or a bit like the projects, it feels like the songs just come. And, you know, a lot of the time I have a sense, oh, maybe I should get the guitar. And not all the time, but there are a number of songs that have come as a whole song, you know, the lyrics, the melody, the music. I've pressed record on whatever device I have and just recorded. And then this whole song has kind of come out. And I've transcribed it after that. You know, I've gone back and written it out. And that's happened a lot. And then, you know, I have worked also in the studio with people, like more recently, someone like Linda Perry. And we would do that together. And that was kind of crazy because I'd been very conscious of doing the music entirely on my own. I really didn't want to collaborate. All of the projects in terms of the presentation are very, you know, very collaborative. Space broadcasts and Bell Labs and all of this stuff, you know, you're of course you're working, if not with just individuals, but with an instrument or with a space, a room. But yeah, with the music, I was like, I just want to do this. This is kind of this pure thing that I just want to do on my own. But then Linda had asked me to come in and say, oh, you know, let's just come in and play me some of your songs. And then she ended up being like, no, actually, let's see if we can write something. And I really didn't want to do that. And I wanted to leave. You know, I was thinking, this is so ironic. I want to get out of here. And so many people would love to be here.
Mm.
But then she got on the Mellotron. She started playing something. And she records everything. So you're in the studio with her and everything's already recording. So I just started kind of singing whatever. And yeah, we ended up writing this amazing song, and we wrote every song like that. We've written a number now, and it would just come out the way it would happen on my own, just with me. It would happen with her, with the two of us. That was really crazy because you're like, wow, this is quite an experience to do that with someone else. You know, she's worked with so many people, and she was just like, wow, this is not common, you know, so that was cool.
So I'm intrigued, was there a moment when the penny dropped and you realized you weren't going to go down a conventional route of, I don't know, making an album, touring the album, then repeating, that you're actually going to rematerialize music?
I like that. Like that as a phrase.
Thanks.
And as a concept. Yeah. No, I mean, I think there were a lot. And it's interesting because going through a lot of these early journals that I recorded for the imprinting installation, which make up the Inner Self channel, there were so many, not that I recorded a few in that vein, but there were so many in the vein of like, oh my God, I've realized how fucked up the music industry is, you know, blah, 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 blah. And this was happening early on because I was getting these offers from a pretty young age.
Because you're in a grunge band, right, for a while?
I was. Yes, I was. Yeah.
Was that when the offers started?
Yeah, it was around, I mean, that was my first band, you know, so, and that was about 14 to 17 or so, you know, and it was really cool stuff, you know, stuff I feel really happy with. And so in a way at the time, it was like, yeah, this is stuff I'm writing. This is, I love it. I believe in it. It was entirely me at that point in time. But I remember these things coming in and imagining like, but will I want to do this? Will I want to keep performing these kind of things in 5 years? And even the idea of like a 5-year period was like, oh man, that seems like binding. And then I'd see what was happening with friends, you know, that were getting picked up or things were happening with them and then they were getting dropped or they were getting completely transformed into something else. And, you know, I remember getting a call for some Simon Fuller thing and they wanted to work with me. And I was like, well, I looked around the office, there were all these like, you know, Emma Bunting and or Bunton or whatever her name is. And
I love Emma Bunton.
Sorry, I'm Emma really Bunton. Sorry. Look, you know, it was just that kind of thing. And I was just, it was like, how would I ever be in this room? You know, or they'd be wanting to put me with a producer and it'd be like, yeah, give us some electronic kind of beats. And I'm like, have you heard what I do? You know, it was just perfect because it was like I got all this information early on about how I was like not interested in that, you know, any of those options. And almost to the point where I remember thinking and writing, I'd kind of rather do anything else. You know, I'd rather like work in a factory than, and there's no knocking people that work in factories, but I'd rather do something like that than do something creative where I wasn't doing it 100% what I wanted to do and in the way I wanted to do it and with that integrity. And that is hard, you know, doing it your way.
Well, I was going to ask, it must be incredibly difficult.
It is. It is. I mean, it's now, you know, it's got easier because, and not easier in terms of there's still a huge amount of work, you know, the exhibition is still a lot of work and there's a reason it's countries and there's whole teams of people doing that. So when that is you or you plus one other person, it's different, but then there's so much freedom and I just get so much joy from being able to do exactly what I want to do and explore what I want to explore and not have someone say, well, no, why are you doing a music dementia study? Or, oh, why are you visualizing CO2 levels? No, you've got to go promote this. Maybe it's just that I can't handle anyone telling me what to do. But no, I feel so strongly about art and the value of art, particularly after doing this music dementia research project, you know, and watching people that are catatonic getting up and dancing and all these amazing reactions and inspired by the work of Oliver Sacks, but then also going on and kind of exploring that further. And I just feel that art is so fundamental in keeping us, you know, alive, you know, sentient and kind of vital. And we really need to respect art and the power of art and what it can do on that level that is so deep and so profound. And so we need to have good art, you know, for it to do things, miraculous things, magical things. And I feel like the music industry at least, but I'd say almost every industry has just got so commodified. I mean, the music industry is just kind of a joke in terms of even 12 years ago when I started doing these different things, I thought it was a joke. And I thought, well, it can't get much worse. And, you know, you look at it and you're just like, this is a shit show, you know. And I'm like, thank God I really did decide to create another pathway because now there is a path there, but there wasn't before. There was no real alternative way of exploring art and these other disciplines and being an artist, I guess more in a Renaissance way, like not in just a, oh, you make music as one of the things you do, so you must want to be on Pop Idol or you must want to play the O2 Arena. It's like, no, I have no desire to do either of those things. You know?
Yeah, yeah. But we have to live, BT. So I'm always interested by the economics of your model. I mean, you're not going to sell your sonic self-portrait, I take it, at the end of the Biennale. How do you make money?
Whether we make money or not, Grant, we still live. So that's the wonderful thing about being alive. It just, as long as we're alive, it kind of takes care of itself. We don't actually need to make a living to live. But yeah, no, of course, there is the keeping the lights on and being able to eat and, you know, look after oneself and things like that. I guess I'm also a very simple person. I don't really like stuff. I'm not interested in stuff. I also feel like we often think we need a lot more than we do. So I'm very grateful just for having somewhere to reside in and having food and having water and being able to walk. Just those sorts of things. I think if you actually really reduce it down to what do we need, because there's a lot that we believe we need and we don't. In that way, you simplify things and then you realize kind of, okay, so what do you need to do to keep doing that? And yeah, it's actually been kind of amazing because just by doing the things I love, you know, then more people want me to talk about that or, you know, I'll get commissions for certain things and they're all kind of very much in line with what I would do anyway. It's like, great, you know, there's no compromise. Because actually I'm just sharing what I love and what I believe and the journey I've had. And if there are different modes of sharing that, then cool. So yeah, a combination of commissions, you know, talks, various installations, you know, performances. I think also when you come at it and you can play and then you can speak and maybe you can show a piece, you know, you're also kind of doing something that maybe isn't so common, because they're like, oh, well, we want something for this event. And then actually you're coming in with these three angles in a way. Yeah, you know, that's kind of how I see it.
How you exist. Yeah, okay, fair enough. Your inspirations are fascinating. It's Elliot Smith, I think Leonard Cohen, who you wrote a dissertation about at university. And as you've mentioned, you've already mentioned him, the other name that crops up is the neurologist Oliver Sacks. Why is he so important to you?
He is so important.
Because he crops up constantly in all the clippings, every article, Oliver Sacks is name-checked.
Oliver and I were actually meant to meet. We were meant to meet through Freeman Dyson, very incredible scientist who I'd become friends with. And he was a big fan of the Music Dementia Project. And he was like, oh, Oliver was my childhood and, you know, one of my oldest friends. He would love this. And you guys have to chat. And it was funny because I chatted with Freeman a lot about music and the brain. And he'd never really spoken to Oliver about it, even though they'd been such good friends. I thought that was fascinating. Anyway, we were going to meet, and then it was actually right around the time of that he died. And I got an email from Freeman on the morning saying, I can't believe it, but, you know, Oliver's died. And it was just this, you know, when you feel like you know someone and you feel like you're kind of working with them, and almost that the baton has been passed on, because he also had theorized that music didn't have to be familiar to exert its emotional pull.
You've mentioned the dementia and music project that you've done, but we probably need to give listeners a slight more background if we could. So can we get into why you got into this business of playing music to people with dementia?
Well, because of Oliver, because I picked up a copy of Musicophilia and didn't know much about it and started reading it. And as I mentioned, I'm not a particularly good reader because I'd want to be writing, but I was fascinated, you know, reading these case studies of using music to pull people out of neurological binds, not just Alzheimer's, not just dementia, but Parkinson's and schizophrenia and autism. And I just thought, well, this has to be the best way of using music. Of course, we all love music, or a lot of people love music, and it's nice just to enjoy it. But to really pull people back when they're on the brink of almost, you know, non-existence, or there's nothing else that can release them from this condition, and then you see what music can do to transform that. I mean, that has to be the ultimate. And I was so moved. I was so grateful that someone like Oliver had gone and grounded what a lot of us know intuitively about music's power in science, because you know how we need science to kind of back up a lot of what we know anyway. I was just really struck by it, and I had no plans to do anything in that vein, you know, on my own or in my future or anything like that. But I then found out that family members had dementia, and I thought, well, I should probably take a leaf out of Oliver's book and just go and play to them and see what happens. And the responses in those performances, you know, that were two family members, but the second of which was actually, it was for a family member living in a care home in Portugal, and he was the only English resident in the home. And the director of the home asked if I wouldn't mind playing to everyone and not just, you know, my relative, and would I open it up for the whole dementia ward? So I did, but I was very aware that I was playing these songs I'd just written, that they were new, they weren't going to evoke any memory, they weren't going to trigger a memory, and they were in another language. And so Oliver had really tested, when it came to dementia and Alzheimer's, he and others had tested familiar music, because that's kind of obvious. You know, if you can trigger a memory, that will help pull someone back, and there's no greater way of doing that than via a song. But he had also theorized that music didn't have to be familiar, and it would also work if it was not connected to the memory component. And so that's what I saw, you know, firsthand in Portugal doing this performance, you know, people waking up and singing along and clapping and engaging. And it was really surreal, because I thought, well, this shouldn't be working, but it is. And that then became this research project, you know, which I, this was about a decade ago, and where I went to all these care homes across the UK. And we essentially recreated, you know, with the doctors and carers and the priory group, we recreated what had happened in Portugal naturally, spontaneously, but with the controls, you know, with things actually in place so that there could be a study around it. And yeah, it was amazing. I've never seen such reactions to music, and ones that really imprinted and made me so conscious of the power that we still really don't understand. We're still scratching the surface of that. So I already knew music was beyond entertainment. I already knew music was something pretty sacred, like with other forms of art and, of course, nature. But he really got me to see or appreciate music as medicine on this level that then kind of made me want to protect it and create more of these ceremonial experiences around it. And not just music, but, you know, almost anything that I was doing, I just wanted it to have the core components that would allow it to go in deep and stay with someone and imprint. And I just felt like Oliver and I were singing from the same hymn sheet. And there have been quite a few things that I've said, maybe giving a talk or in an interview, which then I've later found him saying a version of, and not like, you know, word for word, but after being in the anechoic chamber, I just felt, wow, we are so bombarded, you know, sensorially, because being in that chamber was like a reset. And it was actually it feeling silence on this level, on this physiological level, and realizing we are really getting hit from all angles, you know, with sounds, with stimuli, with things that are kind of coming in often at this same frequency and bombarding us and discombobulating us and leaving us numb and fatigued and unable actually to really absorb what we need to absorb. You know, it's almost like nutrients. We can no longer take in the nutrients. You know, then I'd find Oliver talking about that very aspect of life.
Well, music is the food of love, Beatty, right?
Yeah. But I'm also talking about music, but I'm not talking about music. I'm just,
no, you aren't.
I'm just talking about presence and, you know, things that really move us. And of course, music is a wonderful moving force. You know, it very much is this thing we absorb, and it doesn't ask anything of us. It's not like it needs us to get up and dance or to draw. Of course, we can do those things from listening to music, but it doesn't actually require anything of us. We can just absorb it. So music is a very moving force, but I think there are a lot of things that are like that. And so it's really just about being as conscious as possible, I think, of our consciousness, you know, and why we're here on the planet and what things are vital to and for our consciousness. And that there are these endangered experiences that we're going to lose and that we are losing because we've got this shiny toys that we think are really great and are going to change everything. But I think they're just going to keep breaking. And then we're going to go back and realize, oh my God, this whole playground outside that is the natural world is like far better than all the stuff that has been obscuring our vision, you know, for a couple of decades now, you know, really since the rise of the digital era. And it's ironic because I do use technology. So there's a paradox there. But I think the best things exist in the paradox. And you have to have the two, the technology and anti-technology, the why and why not, the retro, the future. You know, you have to have those two things running simultaneously. That's sort of part of that line that we talked about, because it's never really one thing. But I also think we need the discernment to be able to pull from all these different places and kind of create something that's hopefully the best of all these worlds.
Very good. Very good. BT, our time is basically up.
Okay.
Thank you so basically. Much for talking. So, well, I do have one last question. So that's what basically, I mean, you have the Biennale going on at Somerset House until the end of June. What's after that? What's next?
I don't like talking about what's next because no, and it's, I've only just realized this because I'm sort of like, well, I don't care. Like right now is what I'm in. And that is wonderful just being here now. And I often never know what's next anyway, because all of the projects have been total detours. They were never what I thought I was going to be doing. So yeah, I'd say what next is a tall glass of water, Grant.
Very wise. Very wise. I might have a glass of white wine. But thank you so much for your time. I really, really enjoyed that. You're very generous and I really appreciate it. Thanks, BT.
Wonderful. Thanks so much. This was a pleasure.
To find out more about BT, go to btwolf.com. My thanks go to the series and headline sponsor, the brilliant lighting specialist, Bert Frank. You can find out more about them at bertfrank.co.uk. As ever, there are images from the interviews on my Instagram page, materialmatters.design. You can find all the podcasts that I've done, sign up to our newsletter, and lots of other stuff at materialmatters.design. Finally, this is really important too. If you've enjoyed listening and want to see this podcast flourish, then please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to this from. And it would make me incredibly happy if you went to my Patreon page and made a pledge at patreon.com/materialmatters. For as little as £2.50 a month, you can receive an invite to our private view of the Material Matters Fair, as well as getting access to each episode before it's published to the wider world. Material Matters is a completely independent concern, and any help you can offer would be hugely appreciated. Ultimately, you'll be helping to take the message, the importance of materials, skill, craft, and design to a whole new audience. So that's it for this series. I'm taking a break for the summer. Thanks to all my guests for the last 10 episodes. It's been a blast. Material Matters will be back at the end of August. Until then, thanks very much for listening.